Coming up on today's show, preparations continue for the Queen's funeral this Monday. We'll speak with security expert Christian Luprecht as to just what might be going on in that country right now. Evidence shows that the majority of Canadians have likely caught COVID, so what does that mean? And it's very late, but it looks like we may finally be getting our review into the legalization of cannabis.
Okay, we're going to talk about what's going on right now in London. I can't imagine. It should be very, very interesting. So we're going to chat now with Christian Luprecht, who's a professor at the Royal Military College and Queen's University, editor of the Canadian Military Journal, and author of Intelligence as Democratic Statecraft, published by Oxford University Press. Christian, thank you so much for joining us. Always nice to chat.
Shay, good morning.
Okay, what's going on in London right now? To me, I can't think of anything else that would rise to a security operation of this size. Can you? Is this the biggest security operation, at least in modern times?
Yeah, I mean, it's significant. The London Olympics would have been significant. But the United Kingdom has two advantages here. One is that this is an operation that was literally decades in the planning for this type of event. So you kind of pull out the plan and you roll out the plan. The biggest challenge for your plan, as with any of these plans, is always surge capacity, that there's simply not enough police officers and intelligence officials around that you can deploy. The other advantage that the United Kingdom has, unfortunately, in this regard, is, of course, a decades-long close history with terrorism of various kinds. And that London has always been a target by a number of groups, as have British politicians. And so MI5, MI6, the Metropolitan Police, the National Crime Agency, these are all agencies that are postured with sort of a very keen appreciation of the current threat environment. So it's not just about the immediate tactical response in this situation. It's also about having a domain awareness of what possible threats you might be facing, because ultimately you really want to make sure you intervene and risk mitigate any of those threats before they could ever manifest themselves.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So there's been work from the moment she passed, I'm sure, and they started putting plans in. I'm sure, in terms of logistics and making sure that it goes off, part of hand in hand, there's been a huge security operation being planned right alongside of that. So what's been going on for the last week? What kind of work began almost immediately?
So you'd be collating what the threat environment might look like. You'd be looking at who also would be traveling to this type of event, who might be posing who might be a target for any aggrieved or other groups. Anybody who would be trying to capitalize on this to send a message or so. So understanding the external threats in this case, so people trying to come into the country, internal threats that might be emanating from individuals or from groups, or from anyone's sort of particular type of community. And you'd also be liaising closely with your allies and partners, because under these certain circumstances, it's sort of all hands on deck to understand sort of what the threat environment might look like. And then you would want to posture yourself effectively. So you want to have not just a visible presence as a deterrence, but you also want to have a civilian presence of people who mix in with the crowds and be able to identify sort of challenges you might face. The biggest challenge is probably, and we've seen the United Kingdom do this particularly well, is on the one hand, a capacity to respond and isolate a threat should something arise. And the other is to coordinate, for instance, among the transport system and among the road system. And here the United Kingdom has, unfortunately, again, a lot of experience, but much of this is also making sure that if there was an event, that you can isolate that without that having having any sort of spillover effects that might ruin or otherwise sort of affect the somber posture in place.
So as you said, all hands on deck, and I imagine that includes Canadian security officials and Canadian police officials and from all over the world, right? Exactly. How does that work? Is there one person in charge, or how does everybody know what's going on?
So that's difficult. So yes, so other countries can assist here, but other countries don't have sworn law enforcement duties in the United Kingdom.
Sure. Yeah.
So they wouldn't be able to arrest individuals. They can provide, for instance, an auxiliary type of presence. They can provide a civilian intelligence sort of presence or so, eyes on the ground or so, that can liaise back. But also in these sorts of situations, you don't want to be building the plane while flying it. That is to say, this is a scenario that would have been long rehearsed by British authorities, and so often your own people are the best people to work with, because they know your procedures, they know your legal constraints, they know the way you communicate, and so much of it here is really about building out your headquarters capacity so that you have, in this particular context, eyes and ears on the ground across not just London but the United Kingdom, with your borders, trying to understand who's coming into the country, and being able to deploy your assets in an effective way. So the biggest challenge here will be not just the people you need to have a surge capacity on the streets, but you'll also want to make sure that you can intervene with prospective threats, and send teams out doing, being able to investigate possible threats identified by intelligence services, while at the same time continuing your planning for the event. So that's really sort of where the where there's the greatest challenge in terms of how you coordinate the scarce resources that you have.
From what I understand, there's probably two layers, if you will, going on right now. One of them is in your face. Like if you arrived in London at Heathrow right now, the security at the airport would be much different than it was 2 weeks ago. Same thing if you went to a train station. There's just an increased security presence within the UK right now. Is that what you would expect?
Yeah, so I traveled through Heathrow yesterday, and yes, the lines were long, it didn't look like there was a massive sort of security operation per se underway. But certainly in this sort of circumstance, you want to have a visible presence, yeah, because a visible presence itself will have a deterrent effect on individuals. But that's where you want to be working with your partners. So, for instance, there'll be a lot of people coming into the country over sort of the next few days. And so you want to have visibility on people that you might not be knowing a lot about, but that, for instance, might be on the radar of, say, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, where CSIS might be able to share certain types of awareness about individuals that British authorities might want to question upon arrival in the United Kingdom about their intentions in the United Kingdom. Those sorts of types of information exchange, that would be a considerable help to British authorities. But much of the work, of course, is behind the scenes,
yeah,
because ultimately this is all about risk mitigation. It's about prevention. It's about interdiction. And that means on the front end, detection of any challenges that there might be to a peaceful unfolding of this event.
So that, like you say, behind the scenes right now, all kinds of intelligence work, like checking out anybody who is on the radar as maybe somebody who might try and use an instance like this to cause trouble, knowing exactly where they are and what they're up to, and maybe even having eyes on them. Could it go that far?
Yeah, it's really about intelligence integration, right? We saw this in 9/11. It's not like the 9/11 bombers and sort of wasn't known, as the 9/11 report showed. There were a number of failings of different agencies to share the right intelligence at the right time to be able to put together that large puzzle. And so being able to integrate those many sources of intelligence is, of course, when you have that many people coming in for this type of an event, you're going to have a surge of intelligence reporting. So having your integrated cell that can then parse that intelligence, integrate it effectively, understand what to action and how to action it, that's really the critical decisions. And that's where you require considerable experience on the one hand, which the United Kingdom and UK authorities have, a considerable network, as the United Kingdom has, in particular with Five Eyes countries, but also with European and some of the Commonwealth partners, and the capacity to then be able to integrate that effectively, because the intelligence isn't worth much if you can't integrate it in a way that makes it actionable. But at the same time, you need to ensure that it's all actioned within the rule of law and within the constitutional protections of people's human rights and of people's privacy.
Last one, and then I'll let you go. Watching some of this footage with King Charles, Will and Kate, Harry and Meghan, just wandering out amongst tens of thousands of people, walking into crowds, shaking hands, that's got to be, if you're in charge of their security, that's got to be an absolute nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's a great question to ask. And it also brings us back, for instance, to perhaps the Chrystia Freeland incident recently in Canada. Politicians and these sort of highly exposed figures, we also want to give them a certain amount of agency. Unlike authoritarian regimes where leaders don't mingle with the public, in a democracy, leaders often take great pride in the fact that they mingle with the very people that either elected them or that in this case they represent, that they don't want to be seen as having to be protected from those very people. And so striking that balance, Jean Chrétien was famous, for instance, when he was prime minister, of not wanting to have lots of mounty detail around him, that he wanted them to stand back so that he could interact with the people, which requires a lot more work by the security services on the front end to make sure that they can provide a safe environment in which people can then interact with the public.
Not to get too nitty-gritty, like, how do they do it? I don't see them. I mean, I just see Will and Kate talking to people. Like, where is the security?
And that's what good security should be doing in a democracy, where they can stand back, they can blend in, but you have constant eyes and ears. And you would see when they're out in the public, they'll always be out in a situation where you, for instance, have people with binoculars up on the roofs. You can scan the crowd and you can detect a threat coming before they're ever able to approach. And then the civilians that you've embedded in the crowd can intervene with that individual in order to keep the highly exposed political person safe.
Yeah, it really is amazing. Christian, thank you so much for walking us through it. I appreciate it. If you're a regular listener to this show, you know the rule. We do not talk about COVID on here unless there's something to talk about, and something that we haven't already talked about a lot and usually fight over, right? But there's been some interesting developments this week that do warrant some discussion. The World Health Organization, I got to say, sounded more optimistic than I can ever remember them sounding when they made an announcement on Wednesday saying we are closer to this thing being over than we ever have been before. Not saying it is over, but we're closer to it being over than it ever has been before. Things going in the right direction globally. That's very good news. Also this week, some data out of BC and some other places as well, showing that Canadians have had COVID at some point in terms of the majority of Canadians have, especially younger Canadians, which is another positive indicator for the future. Let's find out why. We're going to chat now with Dr. Timothy Evans, who is the executive director of the COVID-19 Immunity Task Force. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Shay.
So I mentioned the BC data from earlier this week, but there's been other examples just this week, really, and recently, showing that, in fact, most Canadians, we understand at this point, have had COVID, correct?
Well, I think we need to qualify that.
Okay.
In so far as prior to the Omicron wave, which started in December, only a small minority of Canadians had been infected with SARS-CoV-2. In fact, probably 10% across the country. But since that time, in the context of this Omicron wave, which has been much more infectious and had an ability to escape immune detection by the vaccines, that we've seen close to 50% of the Canadian population infected as of July 15th. Our latest data. So yes, that probably means yes, the majority of Canadians since the beginning of the pandemic, a small majority, meaning somewhere around 60%, have been infected with the virus.
So what does that mean for us going forward? Of course, everybody says, we'll see what happens in the fall. We know that's typically when cases start to spike. Given where we are in terms of the majority of Canadians now having had COVID, at least that's our assumption, what does that tell us about where we're headed with COVID, generally speaking?
Well, first, it's really important to recognize that the infection has not been distributed equally across the population. So one of the things that we see is that younger people have been much more infected, especially during the Omicron wave, than older people. And it just so happens that younger people have had much lower rates of vaccination. Older people have had the highest rates of vaccination and have been incredibly vigilant. So when we look at the population over 70, we still have the majority of people over 70 who have not been infected. And if we look at the total number of people across Canada that haven't been infected to date, it's about 14 million. So that's about 35-40% of the population. So one of the things that's extremely important for, you know, almost 40% of our population is that they remain vigilant and avoid infection if they can.
Yeah.
And we know how to do that, but it's just so important to recognize that if you can maintain your immunity through vaccination, which we've got new boosters out, which have some sensitivity to Omicron, that's a much better option than getting infected. And so that's the first message on moving forward. We have a large population who've been amazing in terms of avoiding getting infected. We need to help them continue to remain uninfected and to have their immunity through vaccination.
The data shows that young people, the numbers go way up when you're talking about younger Canadians in terms of rates of infection, right? Does that surprise you? And what does that tell us?
Well, it doesn't in some respects, insofar as we've only recently started to roll out vaccines in that population. So they were the last to get vaccines. And secondly, I think that when you look at younger kids, their proclivity to engage in congregate settings, particularly around schools, but also their recreational activities, are such that transmission of respiratory viruses is much, much, much more difficult. And that's why we see in young kids all of the seasonal viruses and the colds that spread like wildfire in daycare and schools. So in some respects, they have higher risk for transmission. And what we've seen, particularly during the Omicron wave, which is very, very infectious, that the rates of infection in children have gone up to as much as 70% of children being infected.
Yeah, interesting. We'll see where we go from here. Doctor, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really do appreciate you joining us. All right, switching gears now completely. You may remember earlier this summer, I'm not sure exactly how long ago it was, we talked about this legally required Health Canada review of how the legalization of cannabis is going in our country. When we legalized cannabis in 2018, October of 2018, so just shy of 4 years ago, like 3 years and 11 months almost to the day, part of the requirement was at 3 years, we need to do a review. That's part of it. Hasn't happened. And we're now almost a full year past that deadline of when it was supposed to happen by. So there are some indications that it may be on the horizon, though. It may actually be about to take place, as I say, almost 1 year to the day later than it was supposed to. So let's find out what's going on. We're going to talk now with George Smitherman, who is the president and CEO of the Producer Advocacy Group, the Cannabis Council of Canada. George, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good morning, Edmonton.
Okay, so, and Calgary, and all of Alberta, as a matter of fact.
Oh, sorry, yes, of course. all of Alberta.
This review, as I say, has been promised for a long time. We've been expecting it for a while. Hasn't happened. What do you know? Because I still haven't seen it confirmed. Do you know for sure that it's imminent and happening any day now?
Well, what I do know is that had Queen Elizabeth sadly not passed, it would have been announced this week in Toronto, and the government has scheduled, at least confirmed for me verbally, that they will be finally initiating the statutory review on September the 22nd in the nation's capital.
Okay.
And I'm intending to be there.
Excellent. Now, what's the process? Do you know? Is it public hearings? Is it how does it work? How do they go about doing this review?
There are various approaches that they can take, and we've talked about a variety of them, and there's been no clear signal set yet. The only messages that I've been hearing from the government are that the scope will be fairly broad, because many of us were concerned that it was going to kind of not provide an opportunity to talk about some of the real pressing challenges. Yep. So they've signaled that the scope will be broad, and that where necessary, the minister will act on what he hears promptly. But those are just verbal commitments, so we'll have to see what means they wish to use for the review, consultation that travels around, or just online, specialized group of reviewers, independent reviewer submitting a report. We haven't really been given any insight on that basis as yet.
Okay, the pressing issues we'll get to in a moment, but let's go back to what this review was designed to do. What was talked about when it was put into the legislation that we will conduct this review? What is it supposed to be looking at? What's the purpose of it?
Well, the purpose of it, as set out in the legislation, is to ensure that the Act is acting as it was intended to. So it's to look at the operation of the implications of the operation of the Act, with a particular look at some communities of interest, such as Aboriginal communities, and with a look at the overall impact on the public health objectives, which included keeping cannabis out of the hands of youth, getting cannabis consumers to be consuming safe and tested products, and eliminating the participation of the illicit and criminal markets in the cannabis sector. Now, that gets to be interpretive, whether that means narrow or broad, but it seemed like the legal beagles up at Health Canada were kind of saying, oh, well, this is a very, very narrow scope. And for a long time now in the industry, we've been saying, well, there's a lot of pent-up demand and expectation to be talking about quite a wide variety of challenges. So you'd be well to observe a broader scope. So it seems like perhaps they've taken that to heart. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding, as they say.
Now, I've seen some, and I understand why, people saying the reason it's been delayed is because a lot of the arguments that the government made for taking this step, as you mentioned, keeping it out of the hands of kids, getting the black market out of this, getting rid of organized crime in marijuana, hasn't really panned out the way that they hoped it would, and that's why we haven't seen the review brought around quite as quickly. Do you put any stock in that?
Well, the thing is, I can't speculate about why it hasn't happened so far, but I actually would say, like, on some of the things that you mentioned, like, for instance, all the public data that I've seen with respect to youth participation in cannabis seems quite positive insofar as if anything, a delayed uptake amongst Canadian use of cannabis, etc. So some aspects of that public health evaluation seem to be going okay. But when you look at it overall, a lot of the business is still being done in the illicit market. So overall, you have to say that's a public health objective that seems to be coming up somewhat short. But none of that excuses getting on with the review. And frankly, one of the things, like, you know, from the standpoint of the sector, and not just the regulated producers that I represent, but retailers as well, especially across the country in the provinces where you have private retail, really, really squeezed out by the rates of taxation and fees that the various governments are taking. So we're really hoping that the review will at least provide a platform to raise more of those issues about the fundamental fairness of the tax and fees model.
So that's more, you know, as we've moved now almost 4 years past legalization, it's evolved, and those are the issues that you think should be brought forward. That's what you're hoping to hear about?
There's a lot of issues, but, you know, the financial viability of the sector is a real and pressing challenge. Big or small, no matter whether you're operating in one province or several, there's hardly any operators that are finding a cash flow positive experience. And that's not a good sign. In other jurisdictions like California, they've recently recalibrated their tax because a very similar circumstance was occurring. They eliminated taxes at the cultivation level. The thing is, just to kind of make it simpler, you know, simple for the listeners, is that when the cannabis legalization was proposed, the premise was that cannabis was going to be $10 a gram, $10 a gram, and therefore a $1 tax or 10% was reasonable. The thing is, we've got the $1, but instead of the $10 cannabis, we've got $3 cannabis. So the tax is coming in at 30, 35%. Instead of 10, and it's really having the effect of squeezing out our license holders, and frankly making it really difficult to compete on price with that very well entrenched illicit or legacy market. Hey, I was a consumer of cannabis before it was legal. I had a relationship with somebody that I would consider a friend that supplied me with regular product.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had to, that was a significant shift for me to make that break and to change relationships. And I think it's important for people to understand is that there are a lot of, you know, there are, that it's not like when cannabis became legal, all of a sudden 100% of consumers automatically gravitated over there. We have to win that battle one consumer at a time. And if you're not competitive, or at least somewhat closer to competitive on price, it makes the prospect of success quite limited. But that's not the only issue we face, but that's certainly the financial viability of the sector is certainly kind of the underlying foundation for all discussions these days. It's very difficult out there.
George, when we talk about, you know, some of the things that you're talking about, the government may or may not address, but one thing we do know is regardless of how they handle it, it'll take time. Government moves so slowly. The fact that we're a year behind on this review, and I don't know what, they're not going to have this review and the next day things are going to change. I mean, what are we missing out on by the fact that we're a year behind already and now we're just starting on this review and who knows how long it's going to take? I mean, some of these issues are pretty pressing, are they not?
Yeah, really, I try to say that my job these days is to try and build influence so that our industry can demand kind of or create an understanding about the urgency for action.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really is a dilemma, obviously, with the process being delayed. And the process in its own right, if you follow it sequentially, it starts with an 18-month period of report writing. Those reports are then sent on to Parliament and the Senate, who can consider them at committee and perhaps make recommendations, and action could follow. Well, that's 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
At least one very, very interesting election in the midst of all of that. And the likely prospects of survival for very many companies, grim. So I've been really trying to, reinforce the necessity of urgency. And that's why I said off the top, one of the signals that's been sent to me by the minister's office staff is, yes, we understand that some things require more urgent action, and we're prepared to take those out of the queue, so to speak. Like I said, proof is in the pudding, but that was a hopeful message for the government and one that our industry needs to hear, because it's a pretty tough environment out there.
Absolutely. George, thanks so much for the insight. As always, really appreciate your time. Thanks for listening today. To hear any of our other interviews, you can find them wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And if you like what you hear, don't forget to rate and review us.